Yeah, thank you all very much. I think indeed there were plenty of resonances between the various presentations, certainly between Simon's and Isabel's, but also between Simon's and Sebastian's. I thought, for instance, that Sebastian's focus on the ready-made as procedure, as process, rather than as first and foremost an object, is also rather productive in relation to to Simon's strategies and operations. Also the emphasis in Sebastian's talk on the issue of timing. The ready-made is something that is signed and dated and timed. Is something we might want to elaborate, for instance, also in relation to the blockchain. But perhaps let me just ask one question, and then we'll see where we can take it from there about labor, dead labor, social labor, because here there is another resonance between Sebastian focusing on dead labor in industrial production, and then you at a certain point, sort of near the beginning of your talk, you showed us this slide of this factory, and then you said zero human labor is involved. I'm wondering whether there is also a risk involved both in dealing with industrial capitalism and in dealing with contemporary production methods in, let's say, overprivileging dead labor. This, I thought, was a point where we can almost read perhaps Isabel's presentation as a kind of critique of the other two presentations, in that Isabel stressed that the ready-made implies and contains, but also obscures and obfuscates living labor, human labor. So if we focus on, let's say, the labor that has been sedimented in the form of apparatuses, as Sebastian puts it, obviously this is something that this process of sedimentation is going on apace, no question about it. But even if we have this kind of shiny factory today, are there not always forms of human labor, for instance, perhaps the extraction of minerals somewhere in Africa, that actually gets hidden behind those fascinating, wonderful images that we are shown of those completely autonomous factories. Perhaps this question can sort of trigger responses from all of you or any of you. Anybody want to respond to it?
Yeah, I can respond. I mean, I think there's the lights off factory is not necessarily a triumph, and that's certainly not what I was kind of positioning as in my. it's actually a symbol for most people of like loss of jobs. That's what that image usually represents. So I think it's certainly not about obscuring labor with a kind of glittery image. It's about noting that labor is being shunted elsewhere, and the types of labor that used to be paid and done by humans, unfortunately, is now done by machines. And the point that I was trying to make is that actually the labor that now humans are often doing, which is looking and sorting and doing things which maybe, as I say, hopefully made the ready-made get value, are actually being monetized and economic value is gained from at another point, certainly not in a space where the subject is able to be benefiting from that.
No, sure.
So it's not about obscuring labor that happens elsewhere. It's about the loss of the possibility for paid labor, however badly.
Well, there's a kind of double displacement towards sides of extraction of where the raw materials are being extracted, and then towards semiotic labor.
Mining will not be done by humans in the future. It will not. Mm. So that those jobs, however shitty they are, will also disappear.
No.
Yes, so, but yeah. I think, I mean, one could of course raise objections against my use of Marx's labor value theory by saying that I accord a kind of transhistorical validity to concepts that aimed at an industrial society. And we are obviously living in an economy where industrial production has not disappeared. It has been outsourced to so-called, cheap labor countries. But nevertheless, we are also dealing with a so-called financialized capitalism, and one could wonder whether, you know, the whole idea of a commodity that eclipses labor and nevertheless relates to labor can still be maintained in such an economy. And I would say yes. And I would say that you can find, you know, a reflection on that in Marx as well, because he kind of insists very much on how the circuits of production are intricately related to the sphere of distribution and circulation, and he quite thoroughly analyzes also credit and basically points to how all these instruments of credit, you know, nowadays we speak a lot of derivatives, how they seem to be completely, you know, disconnected from labor, but on some level, of course, they are based on exploiting labor as well and on surplus value. So I mean, I think that's why it's in a way legitimate, and I should possibly have said that in my statement, to use Marx for the type of economy that you are interested in dealing with.
Yeah. Absolutely. I would say, actually, you don't even need to look that far. I would say, as I formulated it, hopefully, maybe not clear enough, Facebook is exactly that thing. You know, the platforms are that thing. The labor is obscured. Like, you don't know you're giving your data for money to them.
You don't even get exploited. I mean, you don't get any money for it. You do it completely for free. So
it's a slave. Yeah.
So it's really perfect labor, purified labor. Yeah. Yeah. Now, and you, do you want to respond to this, Sebastian?
I would perhaps ask Isabel a point that I didn't get, and that relates to the discussion. I don't know what you mean by when you say this, that a social labor is eclipsed in the ready-made. Mm-hmm. I cannot imagine how could it not be eclipsed in this kind of. Well, of course, it's not a strictly industrial production mostly, but anyway, it disappears in the product.
Yeah, well, then compare it.
What does Duchamp add to this?
I think you need to compare, when you compare the ready-made, say, to a painting, and I'm assuming here an expanded notion of painting, meaning, you know, that it can also be a painted screen, or it doesn't have to be oil on canvas, but the painting nevertheless highly triggers the fantasy that its value has substance, that the concrete labor of the artist has been somewhat, how can I say, sedimented in it, that you can find traces of these labor.
Yeah, of course.
And this is a suggestion, this is triggered by paintings and the fantasy, I call it vitalist fantasies, that are triggered by painting are also occasioned by them, by their materiality. I think the ready-made, by contrast, puts the emphasis more on, as you also pointed out, you know, social labor, which is the factory, which is seriality, and so forth. Of course, artistic labor is there as well, as I demonstrated, and artistic labor is associated with certain privileges which remain in the ready-made. That's why it's a commodity of a special kind. It's not a commodity like any other commodity, but it shares structural analogies with a commodity in a very specific way.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with one point in your presentation. I agree completely that the ready-made, in a way, is essentially bound to the concept of authorship. So of this kind of privilege that that frames artistic production, and without it wouldn't work.
So different with the ordinary commodity, because the ordinary commodity is produced by workers who mobilize their labor force and who do not own this the product of their labor. So artistic labor is associated with all kinds of privileges. This is why many Marxist art historians actually say that artistic labor has nothing to do with value production and should be exempted from it. I happen not to think so, but this debate would now maybe go too far because it's a kind of Marxological one. But I have a question to you as well, Sebastian. Two questions, actually. One, I have had the impression that you are not so interested in the kind of in the iconographic dimension of Duchamp's ready-made, because what always struck me is that many of these objects belong to the sphere of reproduction. You know, the comb, the cloth hanger, even the urinal, are associated with the sphere of reproduction, with a private sphere. You could even say a sphere that is usually associated as being the sphere of the female, and so on. So does this matter to you at all? Because I felt that this iconographic dimension is kind of not so much present in your work. And could one maybe say that Duchamp, while putting the emphasis on this sphere of reproduction, which is, you know, declared to be the production, does he intuit the increased economic importance of such a sphere in our economy? You know, when you think of Facebook, it's our private lives. It's our, you know, it's our kind of most intimate
effective labor.
That, so is there a kind of intuition maybe of the increased value of the sphere that we find in the ready-made?
Difficult question. Very interesting question. I mean, I'm very interested in the iconography of the ready-mades. Just that this was the most formal sketch I ever gave about what I think is important in this processual reading of the ready-made and of the ready-made as the, in a way, a carrier of a date, which I think is the important link to the commodity form. In the ready-made, not a fetish, but that you need something new so that you have a clean start. You cannot do it with something you found on the flea market. That's why I gave this very formal structure only. I'm very interested in the iconography of the ready-mades, but I never thought about it in these terms that you offered now. I think it's quite obvious, and not my invention, of course, that a lot of the ready-mades are clearly related also to the iconography of the large glass. And this is, I think, for me, this is basic and still not exhausted. I think there's still very many open and very interesting questions. And then, of course, the large glass has to do with body, has to do with sexuality, has to do with ambiguous forms like the pissoir, which is also a mold of the piss in this sense, and or as an inverted waterfall, or you have the cover of the typewriter cover, where we have an inside out. You have the coat hanger where you have the coats are not there. But so perhaps this really relates to what you asked about the concept of reproduction. But I wouldn't know if I could relate this, or would, if I would read this as a symptomatic idea of Duchamp about our contemporary production sphere, where private life is productive or is bound up to value extraction.
But just my second question, and then sorry to, but I just had another moment where I kind of slightly shook my hand, my head when you hand as well, of course, when you kind of stated that commodity is not an issue in the Duchampian ready-made. And I was thinking, you know, for me, if I only consider how much the display strategies that you can detect in his work are communicating with the display strategies, you know, of shops, I really believe that the kind of structural analogies to the commodities and an insistence on the difference or the specificity of these artistic commodities is really an issue that is overlookable in his work. I was puzzled how you could say commodity is not an issue. Or maybe I misunderstood.
At least I didn't put it as strong as you now frame it. I said that the identification of the artwork with the absolute commodity, that this topic that comes up with, in a way, I said latently with something like Donald Judd, manifestly and programmatically, okay, with something like the silver clouds of Warhol. That this identification is not the main issue in Duchamp's relation of the ready-made and the commodity, but I think that the commodity is in a way, or the serial product is in a way a methodological necessity for the ready-made, because it has to be something new or something unused, something that you find on the other side of the shop window. And still not individualized in a way, still not used, still not contextualized. I think it's quite important. You don't find the urinal in the toilet, in the public toilet, and then take it out of its former context.
But the bottle you find it all over in households in France until today.
Yeah, but the bottle rack, perhaps, of course it's a difficult question because we don't know exactly about the bottle rack, but you find it in the Bazaar de l'Hôtel de Ville. It's a new one, and it's not something you don't find. Now you find it, of course, also on the flea market, but I think for Duchamp it's more important that it has no prehistory. And that's done,
in
that's
contrast
guaranteed.
With the
contrast with the objet trouvé, yeah, which has, yeah, comes from this First World War and means this
well,
or that.
You know, I could listen to this conversation for hours.
I'm sorry.
Seriously, but perhaps that's not the case for everybody in our audience. But it's great because what we're doing here, of course, is we are performing the labor of interpretation, which also actually stresses the point that with Duchamp, even though there seems to be a kind of consummation of, you know, a certain model of authorship in his practice, the artist doesn't even have to produce the work, the artist can choose the work, and it's his name or her name, but of course his name in Duchamp's case, that authenticates the work. Even though there is this kind of triumph, it seems, of the artist and his act as an act of choice in Duchamp, because he essentially gives us bits and pieces that we then have to work with, there is also a kind of distribution of labor that is already underway at the time of the production or the selection of the works. And it's very much, I would say, also actually a form of socialized labor. Duchamp would not have created the ready-mades if he had not been part of certain circles, late Cubist, Dadaist, Surrealist circles. So I would say there is also a socialization here that has led to a contemporary situation in which we are indeed dealing with various forms of distributed authorship. And one could also connect that to Simon's practice, which of course, you know, it's your practice and we know you as Simon Denny artist, but we've seen in pretty much all of your projects, and particularly perhaps in the case of the project at the EU Parliament, there is, you know, there are so many forms of collaboration and of the outsourcing of authorship actually that are involved, which I think may be another unexpected relevance that we can perceive in Duchamp. I'm going to open it up to the audience. Perhaps let me just make one final point or reiterate something that Isabel said in her talk. The ready-made is not an innocent or emancipatory proposition, which I think can be quite a productive thought. So we don't have to say, okay, there once was this wonderful thing created by Duchamp and then it became corrupted and it became speculative and so on. Perhaps indeed the ready-made is an interesting and still productive problem because it is not innocent or emancipatory, because it was problematic, not necessarily in a purely negative way, yeah, to begin with. So it's a problem that we can still engage with and work with, which is precisely what all of you have been doing, I think. And is there anybody in the audience who wants to continue with that process? Yes, over there.
I have a quite short question, actually. The first is for Sebastian Egenhofer. I was interested by your cut in the next dimension, or by, you know, the line cuts in the second dimension, the plane, the cuts in the third dimension, and the third dimension, the volume cuts in the fourth dimension. So did I misunderstood you? What I understood is that the grand vert might be the action of being indifferent to a culture or a society, and representing it, the various actors, narratives, belief systems, and material constraints, to represent it, a society or a culture, in a 3D object. And we basically consider that, you know, cultures are streams. We say, oh, this culture, but actually it's always changing. And to say, oh, this culture makes us identify a start and maybe an end, or maybe an open end. So basically, could we say the Grand Vert is some kind of proposition that a culture, if we are not for or against it, because, for example, we are young and we don't think about being for or against it, can be viewed as a ready-made. A second question is for Isabelle Gros. I thought one of the value of the classic artist.
One question per go. You know?
Oh yeah, sorry. It's
okay.
Sorry.
Yes.
I must admit that I didn't really understand the question. I'm sorry.
Because I was, I listened to Marcel Duchamp, who commented that he made choices of things that he was indifferent to. Mm-hmm. And basically the scarcity of these choices was also important for him. So I was wondering, for example, in his Grand Vert, that is, let's say, three-dimensional, if he basically put himself in a position of showing a culture or a society in a specific point of time as ready-made, because basically we are maybe thinking this is good in society or that is good, or we are, you know?
That's a complicated thought, at least. Of course, the indifference of the ready-made in the moment of choice, that you don't have to be interested in it, that you don't you neither have to like nor dislike it, is of course an important point. That this moment of decision is in a way also very clear, and that the machine in which the decision takes place in a way is stable and quiet, and it that doesn't have to be any convulsive beauty or so, and any excitement, aesthetic excitement. But the large glass, of course, is also a very complicated, a very complicated Auseinandersetzung with the culture and with the social roles that are prescribed by a culture, like in the malls of the bachelors, for example. So I don't think that it is a machine that implies the indifference towards a culture, and I don't know how I would relate this indifference of the ready-mades to the complicated iconography of the large glass in this respect. I cannot answer better at the moment.
Here in the front.
I don't even have a question, Dieter, but two comments that I feel compelled to make. I mean, you were talking about the ready-made as eclipsing social labor and the question of authorship. I just want to point out that with three ready-mades, you know, let's say with Underwood, the typewriter cover, has the name of the company on it. Duchamp, when it came to the urinal, he was always referring to Mott Ironworks, where he got his pun from, or at least in part, Richard Mott. The comb that you keep referring to has inscribed on it Chess F. Bingler, with the address of the actual maker of that comb. So I do think that there is at least, you know, some space when we look at the ready-mades that the actual labor behind making this is mentioned and is inscribed on those very important ready-mades. And the other thing, I mean, I very much liked where the discussion is going, but when we talk about the ready-made market, I just want to say that I think that there's something in there for young artists when it comes to the artistic practice vis-a-vis the market. While we're living in a time where the art world is almost at an exact overlap with the art market, for the better or for the worse, it was Duchamp who early on showed the way that it was important to him not to have his works be sold and resold at auction and everywhere else. He made very sure that his most important works would end up with very, very few collectors, and he would make sure that those collectors would give those works to very few museums, the Museum of Modern Art, the collection in Yale, as well as, of course, most importantly, the Philadelphia Museum of Art. So the greatest trick of Duchamp as a trickster would also be that for such a long time, and only recently it has changed because there's only ephemeral works around, you know, he has been short-circuited the art market and did not play a role in it. And I think that is a strategy in and of itself that I would wish young artists could learn more from as they start selling out at a very early age.
I would like to answer.
Sure, go ahead.
First of all, I think that looking at the Mutt inscription or the inscription on the typewriter Hülle, one realizes that it's about acknowledging brands, and this is not necessarily meaning that, you know, social labor is literally emerging in these works. But what I try to say is that social labor, yes, is somewhat contained in the ready-made and rendered invisible in the same time. So it's a kind of dialectic construction. What you say about Duchamp, I think, comes close to the kind of official legend, because when one looks more closely, and Dieter Daniels in his book Duchamp and the Anderen has demonstrated that very convincingly, one realized that Duchamp was a dealer artist. And, you know, he was a force in the art market. Not only did he deal with Brancusis, he was also a kind of agent and advised collectors and so on, Katrin Dreyer. I mean, I think that this whole idea that he was outside is a fiction. He didn't produce in a way that his colleagues would produce, like, you know, continuously, but he was definitely an agent in the art market.
He kept the separation between being a dealer, for example, of Brancusi, and of being an artist who most of the time gave his work without much profit to trusted hands. So I think exactly this separation is what makes the model interesting, of not intermingling what is not the normality today, you know.
Well, I think like artists wearing different hats, being artists, dealers, writers, curators at times, is a model that is very widespread nowadays. I've called this in my book High Price the erweitertes Kompetenzprofil, the enlarged competence profile. And I think it's always most interesting when the inner contradictions and tensions that result from these multiple hats are actually addressed in the work.
I would have liked to ask Oliver Laric from who does these 3D scans with a lot of money and work involved and gives them for free, how this works on the commercial side. But perhaps we can postpone this to the final discussion.
Let's see, how are we doing time-wise? We do have 5 more minutes. I'm going to start to wrap things up. Are there any urgent questions that, yeah, there's one over there. Okay, then let's say that this is the final question, or at least the first final question.
It's just a little thought on the relationship of the ready-made and the commodity fetishism. Marx, as we all know, says that the exchange value, not the use value, the exchange value of the commodity seems to be something that is inherent in the object, but actually it's not. Because it's only a symptom, so to speak, of a certain kind of social constellation. And if we transfer this thought to the ready-made, I think it's important to notice that the ready-made is not a symptom of something that has happened before, but it is something that will happen in the future. So it's a symptom of the work, the labor that has to be done by the recipients, the people who look at, the regardeur. So it's a completely turnaround. It's not the end of the process that reflects how it has come about, but it's the beginning of a process that is going on, so to speak, starting from nothing.
Probably not. I wouldn't say from nothing, because there is first, of course, there is this in a way eclipse. I still don't understand how it couldn't be eclipsed. That's for me still the point.
Think of the Eugène Leroy painting in contrast.
No, yeah, of course, there it's not eclipsed, but the social labor that is produced in any kind of serial product is eclipsed in the product, whether it's a ready-made or not, or whether it becomes a ready-made or not. And of course, if there's an inscription on it from the company or so, then one knows the company, but one doesn't see the labor in the product.
Yeah, that's true for every commodity. That's exactly why the ready-made is structurally analogous to a commodity, but it's also a commodity of a special kind because of the privileges associated with artistic labor that are also kind of sedimented in it.
Yes.
What I wanted to say exactly, this privilege labor of authorship is also, it's so complicated, and to construct an author who is able to frame it, to date it, to have the connections to Alfred Stieglitz, to have this to conceive all this framework in which the retroactive or reception process by posterity takes place. This is a very complicated process, and so I don't think it's only from the future backwards, but it's also constructed by the author, by the artist, and the artist himself is a social construct also, just in this sense.
Yeah. If I may also say one sentence about what you suggested, I think that if we want to grasp, you know, the value question, if we really want to understand how value is kind of founded in artworks, we first of all have to understand that value is never intrinsic. It's a kind of social relation, and we have to look at the sphere of artistic production, the sphere of labor and the results of this labor, as much as on the sphere of artistic reception, the kind of collective desire that is projected on some works and not on others, and therefore also constitutes value. So value is, I think, both founded in the sphere of production and in the sphere of reception. So I would half agree with you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. And indeed, I think those are good. Is there a final
two.
Question? There's two. Okay. Let's be tolerant.
I would like to make a comment and end on a very kind of positive note. What I find is most interesting that Mr. Duchamp decided to live a very comfortable life. He fell in love with Tini Duchamp, Tini Matisse. She was used to a very comfortable life, business class flights, good hotels. And then he decided to make an edition of the ready-mades with Arturo Schwarz, which I think is a great momentum, because he's making fun of this religious admiration of Duchamp. He lived his life in a very wonderful way. So the sense, he's like a great fucking comedian. He is a genius because of that. And this whole labor issue, yes, but that is an issue, as Simon Denny proves, is not relevant anymore. Under those circumstances, you discuss them from a Marxist point of view. So the fact that change, he envisioned it and he made it possible. But don't get stuck in your historical stupid being caught in this. Talk about the future. Talk about the situation of the fucking question of the market. What does it mean for artists today? So we are talking about an issue which historically is significant, but you should end it on a positive note. Leben geht weiter. You see, the fact what happens that UNESCO, America leaves UNESCO, what does this mean? What does this mean politically? Duchamp was very smart to avoid political questions, right? He almost circumvented them completely. He probably was a great lover, but all the women he was in love with had money. So he was an interesting character. These dandies don't exist anymore. There should be more of them in the future.
Thank you very much. Thank you for this intervention. I don't know if at the moment if ending by discussing the future is the same as ending on a positive note, but is there anyone, Simon or Isabel, or do you want to respond to that? Or yeah.
I couldn't possibly comment.
Okay, then we'll end it on that note. I think we need a couple of follow-up symposia. We need a follow-up symposium on matters of labor and value. Is the Marxian labor theory of value entirely obsolete, or does it still have some relevance? Is there a real autonomization of dead labor? We need a follow-up symposium on matters of time and duration. According to Rocher, Marcel Duchamp's greatest work was the use of time, l'emploi de son temps. This is something we've touched on but haven't fully discussed. And we need a follow-up symposium on many different questions that we have raised without answering them. But thank you very much, everybody. And now I think, Dieter, you want to say something straight away, right?
We have a very short... Is this on? Yeah? We have a very short break now, and then, Kasper, is he out again? Yes. We have prepared the positive note. It's ready there, and you know that this will be part of the unveiling of the future of the ready-made, you know, which is still out there undiscovered. So how long is the plan for the break?
10 minutes.
10 minutes, you know? And then it will be a very short session, not like these 19 minutes. It's just me and Sebastian over there. So it's more like 20 minutes. And then we have, if you want, a kind of final open discussion, but we still have in the break to decide who takes part in that discussion. Maybe only the chairs, or maybe only the artists, or all of us who are here. This is kind of a little bit in the making, you know, but we will try to respond to you as good as possible. So 10 minutes break, then very short session, and then some kind of undefined ending.